My name is Michael McCusker. It's a very warm, wet, tropical wind off the ocean this morning. I walked straight into it and felt like I was back on the pond again. And I think it's carrying some water now. It was just a little moist as I was walking here. And it felt really nice. Which sort of means that the equinox is coming upon us, and that will be tomorrow. And I'd like to read an article that appeared in the New York Sunday Times this last Sunday by Richard Cohen, who wrote a book called Chasing the Sun, the Epic Story of the Star That Gives Us Life. A fascinating book, which is going to be probably take me as long to read as War and Peace. I'm about maybe a quarter of the way through the sky. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker. In my reading of it. Autumn. Party time across the world. When is the fall equinox? For those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, it will fall very precisely at 5:05 Eastern Daylight Time on Friday morning, September 23rd. In 2010, it was also on September 23rd. But in 2008 and 2009, it was on September 22nd. It has also occurred on September 24th. And a little note here that apparently here in Astoria, the equinox is actually Monday, September 26th, when our day and night on the Columbia Pacific will be of equal length this year. A little something I added. It will not fall on the 21st, the date most people think is the equinox, until 2092. When autumn has four different birthdays, the anniversary becomes devalued, which may explain why the September equinox, along with its sibling, the vernal equinox in March, has always seemed the slighter of the year's markings set against the summer and winter solstices. Equinoxes are very exact points in time, yet the term itself is misleading. It derives from the Latin for equal night and refers to the sun's center being directly over the equator at solar noon, creating a moment when the duration of day and night is reckoned identical. It is true that for most places on Earth, there are 2 days a year when day and night have almost the same length, when sunrise and sunset are closest to being 12 hours apart. But day is about 14 minutes longer than night at the equator, and even longer toward the poles. This year, it is 94 days from the June solstice to the September equinox, but only 89 days from the December solstice to the March equinox. Because of the elliptical nature of the Earth's orbit, the seasons are not of equal length. So although we like to think that our year is neatly cut into quarters, it isn't. None of this stops the world from marking the September event as special. Throughout history, the first day of autumn has been considered a good time to take stock of the year's successes and failures. For our hemisphere, Libra, the scales, the only inanimate sign of the zodiac, is an occasion for balancing accounts. A myth in many cultures holds that some mystical force lets us stand eggs on their ends, but only for a few hours immediately before or after the exact time of the equinox. Literature enjoys such staging points as well. In The Mysterious Island, published in 1874, Jules Verne invokes equinoxes at length, while in the Just So stories, Kipling tells of the elephant's child who suffers from satiable curiosity. If you remember, the Mysterious Island is when Captain Nemo reaches his final equinox, so to speak. One fine morning in the middle of the procession of the equinoxes, this satiable elephant's child asked a new fine question that he had never asked before. He asked, "What does the crocodile have for dinner?" Then everybody says, "Hush," in a loud and dreadful tone, and they spanked him immediately. The next morning, when there was nothing left of the equinoxes, because the precession had proceeded according to precedent, the elephant's, and that's a quote, the elephant's child sets out to find what the crocodile has for dinner, and they all spanked him once more for luck. And that's again a quote, and this is from Kipling's Just So Stories. Hardly cause for celebration, but then in Greek mythology, autumn begins when the goddess Persephone returns to the underworld to live with her kidnapper, Hades. I got that one right, but Persephone, I'm not sure if I pronounced her correctly. In repayment of the 6 pomegranate seeds she illicitly ate, a harsh balancing. Other mythical creatures, like gnomes, minotaurs, and the Sphinx, are associated with the autumnal equinox, as are wolves and birds of prey. My own favorite celebration takes place in Annapolis, Maryland, where boatyard employees and sailboat owners recognize the spring equinox with a burning of the socks festival, redonning socks at the colder equinox. The Japanese celebrate September with their week-long Higan, Other Shore, festival, and honor the spirits of the dead reaching nirvana after crossing the river of existence by cleaning and decorating the graves. China has its own celebration, the Moon Festival, when the streets are decorated with lanterns and dragons dance. A mooncake with filling ranging from melon and lotus seeds, almonds, minced meats, bean paste, orange peels, and lard, to a salted duck egg yolk, which might be 100 years old, placed at the center, is particularly popular. Traditionally, 13 such cakes are piled in a pyramid to symbolize the 13 moons of a complete year. In the Iranian calendar, the equinox is when Mehrigan, the festival of Zoroastrianism, is celebrated. In Korea, Chuseok is a major harvest festival and a 3-day holiday. Again, my apologies for pronunciation. The Christian church, not to be outdone, replaced early pagan celebrations with Michaelmas, also known as the Feast of Michael and All Angels. And that's me. But set it on September 29th. Modern pagans celebrate Mabon by giving thanks to the sun. The name was introduced sometime in the early 1970s, having been drawn, seemingly at random, from Welsh mythology to impart a more authentic Celtic feel. It is not all ghouls and gales, though. The equinox is said to produce a reduction in the magnetic field of the Earth, allowing easier access to other dimensions, making this a propitious moment to be in a power spot, in a forest, near a lake or sea, in a holy place, or even in your own backyard. No spanking necessary. And that's from Richard Cohen, Autumn Party Time Across the World. And if any of you could find a copy of Chasing the Sun, read it. It's fascinating. I would like to now read an article that, actually it's a letter, that Jody Kruger gave me, written on September 11th by a mutual friend of ours named Aloha Heart. Dear family and friends, I am writing my heart to you that it may have voice through these written words. Each morning I awake feeling my heartache for the fears, suffering, and desperation of millions of people. In the past, I have felt it more globally. Lately, I feel it for my friends, neighbors, and countrymen. I am near 60 years of life, and never before, not even during Vietnam, have I felt this level of devastation. I feel my country is in the midst of a crisis of the heart and soul that is expressed by greed, meanness of spirit, and blatant disregard for the suffering of millions of our fellow citizens and neighbors. Profits, wealth accumulation, and bottom lines seem to be our God. In Capitalism, A Love Story, his 2009 documentary, Michael Moore said, quote, the richest 1% have more financial wealth than the bottom 95% combined, unquote. Recently, on March 5th, in a speech to protesters in Madison, Wisconsin, Moore pointed out that just 400 Americans, 400, have more wealth than all Americans combined. And in parentheses, she lists, Aloha does, www.politifact.com, in case you want to catch those numbers. Food banks cannot supply even basic nourishment for the people who line up at their doors. Millions of our children, families, veterans, disabled and mentally ill, are homeless and hungry. Yet it still is often said that we are the freest and greatest nation on earth. Mahatma Gandhi once said, "A nation's greatness is measured by how it treats its weakest members." How are we treating our children, elderly, poor, and disabled? Recently, I received a letter and graph from the American Friends Service Committee, commonly known as the Quakers. What I observed about our national priorities brought me to tears and a moment of feeling complete desolation. The graph shows that 60% of our nation's budget goes to the military. That translates into approximately $1.2 million per minute. The USA spends more on the military and defense than the combined totals of the next 15 largest military budgets: China, Russia, Britain, France, Japan, Germany, Saudi Arabia, South Korea, India, Brazil, Italy, Austria, Canada, Indonesia, and the Netherlands. During the last 10 years we have been at war, our taxes have been lowered 3 times. Never in the recorded history of the world has a country lowered taxes and only borrowed money to finance war. Yet that 60% does not include a social or economic fabric to sustain and rebuild the lives of our servicemen and women who are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, some of whom have been deployed to war 3, 4, 5, 6, or more times. Dwight Eisenhower once said, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed." It seems to me we are witnessing the reality of Eisenhower's words today. Only 7% of our budget goes to health and human services. Researchers at Harvard Medical School released a report in September 2009 saying, "Nearly 45,000 people die in the USA each year, one every 12 minutes, in large part because they lack health insurance and cannot get good care." And that's attributed to Reuters News Service. Our public servants in Congress have the best health care insurance available in this country. We, the taxpayers, support members of Congress making six-figure salaries with great health insurance and a golden pension plan, while they continue to ignore the needs of 26% of Americans ages 18 to 64 who cannot afford health insurance for themselves or their families. This 26% does not include children without health insurance. The Economic Populist of November 10, 2010, and that's the attribution for those figures. In the world, 45 countries have lower infant mortality rates than the USA. We are 0.06 infant deaths per 1,000 births, or 6 6,000ths infant deaths per 1,000 births. Monaco has the least infant deaths at 1.79 deaths per 1,000, and that's from the Mundi Index of 2011. Only 6% of our budget goes to education. The USA ranks 14th in the world out of 34 industrialized nations listed by the Paris-based Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in 2010. We are failing our children, and we are not laying the foundation for a highly functioned, well-educated society in the future. My investment group sent a letter informing investors that profits were projected to rise 12% for corporations in the next year. That was not reason for me to rejoice. Rather, that information hit my heart with a thud, reminded me of the vast and ever-widening gulf between the wealthy and the poor in this country. Right now, as I'm writing this, a song called "Lonely Like America" is playing. That seemed quite appropriate. Yet, Yes, many times I feel lonely like America, longing for national unity, community, and caring for one another in our homeland. I long for the extension of our hearts and hands to one another across this land. There are moments when I feel afraid, yet I do not give fear a seat in my heart. Instead, I do what I feel called to do, as I trust you do also. I am certain that together we can move through fear, hatred, and alienation. We can meet one another with love, respect, and non-judgment. We can learn to respectfully disagree and together find a common ground of our shared humanity to stand upon. We can turn off the voices of fear, hate, and separation on our radio, TV, newspapers, and magazines. We can listen to that still voice within. We can join in a spirit of love, kindness, and forgiveness, and we can embrace and celebrate diversity. We can, through faith, trust in the transformative power of love. May we create a nation of compassion, cooperation, ingenuity, integrity, and courage. And may we leave to this generation and future generations a legacy of clean air and water, beauty, sustainable living, and creativity. May we live in a spirit of oneness, embracing all races, creeds, faiths, and personal choices pertaining to human relationships. May we do all this and more with the help of divine wisdom and guidance. May we move from this darkness into a new age of the Renaissance of the heart. I invite you to join me on this journey. Do all you can with what you have in the place you are with the time you have. Do all you can. And that is a quote from Nkosi's song, written by a 12-year-old African orphan. May our hearts open and our spirits soar. Love, joy, and peace, blessings abound. Aloha, heart. And P.S., if you feel to share this with a friend, I am grateful. If you want to email this to your friends, contact me at alohadaryl@gmail.com, and I will forward it to you. Blessings, aloha. And I think she means that by her name and her greeting. Well, today is the publication in the United States of a book called Time for Outrage, written by Stephen Hessel of France. I read the book, or most of it, on this program, because it's a very small book, a couple of months ago. And a fellow by the name of Charles Glass, who is the author of Americans in Paris, Life and Death Under Nazi Occupation, and who was ABC News' chief Middle East correspondent for 10 years, and is the London publisher of this book, wrote an article for The Nation about it, and I'd like to read now, as most I can anyway. Time for Outrage on the American publication of Stefan Hessel's Inde News Vu. Time for Outrage, and today is the day it hits the streets. It's off the press. Toward the end of 2010, a small book by a 93-year-old man unexpectedly reached the summit of the bestseller list in France. Time for Outrage, by Stefan Hessel, sold more than 600,000 copies between October and the end of December, propelling it above Prix Goncourt winner Michel Houellebecq's novel Les Cartes de l'Électeur Territorial, I do not speak French, by several hundred thousand copies. Hessel had written other books. His publishers, the independent Indigene Editions in Montpellier, far from Paris, had produced other volumes, but none had reached the public in such numbers. The book both reflected and anticipated the spirit of student demonstrations in France and Britain, as it did the wave of revolt now challenging dictatorships in the Middle East. Hessel's life would make a novel, although his story is too hopeful to be told by nihilist Houellebecq. His father, Franz Hessel, was a German Jewish writer who emigrated to France with his family in 1924, when Stefan was 7. Franz's friend, Henri-Pierre Roche, used him and his wife, Prussian beauty Helen Grund, as models for Jules and Kate in his 1953 novel, Jules and Jim. This was the enchanting tale of a woman who loved and was loved by two men that was translated to the screen in 1962 by François Truffaut. Hessel belonged, the attitude of the majority, I'm jumping for a moment, the attitude of the majority of Stefan Hessel's military colleagues found expression in the decision of a French court-martial, because he served in the French army during the Battle of France, and like more than a million other French soldiers, became a prisoner of war. Following his escape from a POW camp, he joined General Charles de Gaulle and his small band of Free French Resistance. His was a rare act of patriotism when most of the French professed loyalty to Vichy leader Marshal Philippe Pétain and his policy of collaboration with Germany. The attitude of the majority of Hessel's military colleagues found expression in the decision of a French court-martial that sentenced de Gaulle in absentia to death for treason. Hessel belonged to a tiny minority that was outraged enough to oppose Pétain's new order, which replaced liberty, equality, and fraternity with work, family, and nation. While Stefan Hessel was working with de Gaulle in London, Franz Hessel died in France. Stefan parachuted into occupied France in advance of the Allied invasion of 1944 to organize resistance networks. The Gestapo captured him and subjected him to a form of torture that would later be called waterboarding. He was transported to Buchenwald and Dora concentration camps, avoiding the gallows only by switching identities with an inmate who died. While being transferred to Bergen-Belsen, he escaped. He became a diplomat after the war and was involved, along with Eleanor Roosevelt, in drafting the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Awards and honors followed, the most recent of which are the Council of Europe's North-South Prize in 2004. And throughout his post-war life as a diplomat and writer, Hessel has retained the sense of indignation that drove him during the war. This book is a testament to his belief in the universality of rights, as his defense of Palestinians under Israeli occupation and of illegal immigrants in France attests. The popularity of this slim but powerful volume answered the public's need for a voice to articulate popular resentment of ruling class ruthlessness, police brutality, stark income disparities, banking and political corruption, and victimization of the poor and immigrants. Hessel had arrived in France when many of the French were decrying Jewish immigration as a threat from the East. Of course, the real threat from the East was the Nazism that many of the French right admired as an antidote to what they perceived as the indiscipline of French society. Their intellectual heirs, echoing the earlier distaste for foreigners and for the ostensible fecklessness of the working class, hold positions of power in France today. Hessel writes in his book, "How lucky I am to be able to draw on the foundation of my political life, the Resistance and the National Council of the Resistance's program from 66 years ago. That program, declared on March 15, 1944, set out the wartime and significantly post-war goals of the Resistance. Defeating the Nazis and their French collaborators was only a stage. The combined resistance declared on the way to a true and economic social democracy." Hessel rejects the claims that the state can no longer cover the costs of such a program. It managed to provide that support immediately after the liberation, when Europe lay in ruins. How could it not afford to do the same after it became rich? Similarly, in Britain, the state paid for free universal education, including higher education, free universal medical care, and other benefits that improved the health and well-being of the country's children immeasurably after a war that left the nation bankrupt. Now, after half a century of prosperity and the accumulation of fabulous fortunes, the government says it can no longer pay for the social rights for which an earlier generation fought and for which it voted overwhelmingly in 1945. The British coalition government's cuts in social benefits, its dramatic increase in the cost of university education, and its transformation of the National Health Service into blocks of private trusts come in tandem with its absolution of the tax obligations of major corporations like Vodafone and its public subsidiaries to private banks. Outrage and indignation are not appropriate responses. Our politicians, guided by corporations and banks that rob the taxpayer when their business models fail, have revoked rights for which the anti-fascists struggled. To erode these gains in France, Britain, and the other countries that fought against the Nazis in Imperial Japan is to reject the gift of the wartime generation's legacy. The countries that opposed the Germany-Italy-Japan axis called themselves the United Nations before they established the organization of that name. Franklin Roosevelt enunciated the four freedoms for which the American people were struggling: freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. Roosevelt's ideals found their way into the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Quote, "Whereas disregard and contempt for human rights have resulted in barbarous acts which have outraged the conscience of mankind, and the advent of a world in which human beings shall enjoy freedom of speech and belief and freedom from fear and want has been proclaimed as the highest aspiration of the common people." Quote, unquote. The conscience of Stefan Hessel was outraged, as it had been during the war. Whenever the post-war world betrayed the resistance program in the Universal Declaration. In France, he found himself in the minority, as he had when he joined de Gaulle, who demanded the right of Algerians to govern themselves. More recently, he has called on Israel to grant Palestinians the right for which French men and women fought in 1944, for which Algerians struggled in the 1950s and 60s, and which Israelis claim for themselves: the right to self-determination and thus self-government and independence. To support those who seek this end, he has endorsed the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement to sever economic collaboration with Israeli settlements in the occupied territories, all of which depend on the removal of indigenous inhabitants and are illegal under international law. In France today, Hessel calls on the young, many of whom have already marched through the streets with their Intuit fury at President Nicolas Sarkozy's reforms, and that's a quote. They resent the balance Sarkozy is achieving between benefiting the banks while depriving the unemployed, the old, students, immigrants, and the poor. Hessel's call for a renewal of the spirit of the resistance, albeit a pacific one, resonates in French traditions that immigrants embrace. It will do the same for youth in Britain and the United States, whom Hessel calls upon to remember their history and to defend its highest achievements. This may be the first time in an ostensibly free country that praise has been applied to the courage of canceling a debate, because a debate was canceled in which Hessel was to speak. Such courage was not confined to the censorious director of the school in which he was to speak. Victory for free speech when the administrations at other colleges succumbed to the pressure and refused to allow Hessel to speak on their campuses. In the bizarre world of what passes for philosophical discussion in modern France, to prevent someone from speaking could be nothing else. The old resistance fighter is battling those who would deny him his well-earned platform. Having taken on the Nazis, survived two concentration camps, and kept his mind and spirit intact for 93 years, Hessel should easily defeat Sarkozy's functionaires and their apologists. The question before us is, will we stand up to demand our own right to be heard? And that was an article written by Charles Glass for The Nation, which I'm afraid I jumped over several paragraphs and kind of probably got confusing. A Time for Outrage. I don't know who is really the publisher, but it's being published today and it's off the press today. And I will be back next week if the sky doesn't fall or I fall into the river or a truck runs me down. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.